ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. I'm Keith Bradshaw with the New York Times, and I'll be your host today on behalf of the Professional Committee of the Board of Governors of the Club. Before I introduce our guest, I'd just like to make our usual housekeeping announcement. Please, please turn off your cell phones now, everybody. If everybody pulls them out at the same time, checks now. Don't be embarrassed to do it now, but we will embarrass you if you end up disrupting it later, particularly as we have a number of television cameras here. We want to make sure everybody can hear exactly what he has to say. With that, I'd like to introduce our guest. Some of you may remember him from previous visits, so I'll be brief, but many of you probably know his bio. One of the most famous investors for decades now in emerging markets. He is the executive chairman of the Templeton Emerging Markets Group. He did his bachelor's and master's at Boston University. He did his PhD in economics at MIT. Even in the 1980s, when people were skeptical about Russia, he was one of the first to really talk about the advantages of going into Russia, or even most recently, Myanmar. He's been taking a look at what's going on there. With that, I give you Mark Mobius. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back. The good news is the food is terrific. The bad news is I've come here to promote a book. And by the way, the other bad news is that Wiley bought the wrong book. Did they get the right book finally here? I've got a new book out. The Little Book of Emerging Markets. And I recommend it very highly. No, it's a, you know, we finally, you know, we have a comic book out too, which I can show you, but I decided that this was a good thing to do because the typeface is big, it's easy to read, and it's very short. So if you want to learn about emerging markets and how to make money, this is a good way to do it. And you can see I've also published a book on equities, a book on mutual funds, a book on foreign exchange, all done by Wiley. And many, many years ago, in 1973 here in Hong Kong, I published a book with Mr. Simmel called Trading with China. And I never forget it. I mean, here's a good example of economic projections. At that time, we projected trading, you know, how much trading would be with China. And everybody said, you are absolutely insane. There's no way that China could reach those levels of trade. And our, at the end of the day, our estimates were way under what actually happened, which is why I really believe that the world belongs to the optimists. And you can see some of the other books we've had, Passport to Profits and so forth. I don't know whether, oh yeah, there's my comic book. You see, it's a manga done in Japanese, and then it was translated into English and a few other languages. So if you want a really quick view of emerging markets, you get the comic book, and your kid will probably steal it from you and learn about emerging markets. Now, how about the outlook? If we look at emerging markets, of course, we in the fund business are interested in performance, and you can see over the last 10 years, 8 of those years, emerging markets have outperformed the US and the world. And I believe that is going to continue as we go forward. Emerging markets are going to continue to outperform, and I'll tell you why. If you look at the 5-year period, you can see that most of those periods, emerging markets were outperforming. If you look at the 10-year, emerging markets have outperformed by a wide margin. And if you look at emerging markets from the very beginning in 1987, they've really outperformed the US and the world. By the way, a lot of this presupposes that you are going to dollar cost average. In other words, you put in the same amount of money every month or every quarter over all this period. You do not do what my sister-in-law did. She bought at the top of the market in 97. By the way, now it looks like a little blip on the screen. But it was a big bull market then. And then there was a crash after that, and I had to visit my brother. And I remember knocking on the door of their home, and I could hear her voice behind the door, "Who's there?" I said, "It's Mark." She said, "I'm not opening the door, and give me my money back." I said, "If you open the door, I'll tell you how to get your money back." She opened it a little bit, but kept the chain on the door. She said, "How?" I said, "Buy more." She slammed the door in my face. This is the problem. People buy the top and they sell the bottom. And you have to be warned not to do that. You have to, if you don't have discipline, dollar cost average. Now, if we can understand equities in emerging markets, we have to look at supply and demand. If you look at the supply, you'll see that in 2001, IPOs and follow-on issues in Hello. How's that? Ooh, how's that? What did you miss? Should I go back for a few slides or no? No, okay. All right. So you can see IPOs and follow-on issues in 2001 represented about 10% of the world in emerging markets. Now emerging markets, IPOs and follow-on issues represent 40% of the world. In other words, there's been an avalanche of new issues coming into emerging markets. And if you look at the 07 number, you'll see we reached over 350 billion. And in 2010, we reached over 450 billion. Now, that's great news for people like me and our colleagues in the industry because we have a lot more choices. But it does tend to depress the market because you have too much paper coming out into the market. If you look at IPOs and follow-on compared to the U.S., emerging markets now surpasses the U.S., which, of course, is the biggest market in the world. Now, how about demand? If we look at the demand, you'll see that the market capitalization of emerging markets has gone from about 8% of the world in 2000 to now over 30%, 34% to be exact. Most people have that yellow band, 3 to 8%, in their portfolios, which means that most people are underweight. They have too little in emerging markets, and they're missing out on great opportunities. Of course, the amount of money coming into our funds and other funds, emerging markets funds, has been increasing, as you can see here. Cumulative inflows have been very good, but not nearly enough to get up to 34%. Now, why are we interested in emerging markets, and why are we excited? Well, it's very simple. Growth. We're looking at incredible growth. This year, we're expecting 5.4% average growth in emerging markets versus about 0.8, less than 1% in the developed countries. Last year, we achieved 6% growth in emerging markets average versus 1.4% in the developed market. By the way, a lot of people say, how do you get that high number? Well, it's very simple. Go to Africa. You may be surprised. In the last 10 years, the 10 fastest growing countries, 9 of them were frontier markets, places like Vietnam, Bangladesh, and 6 of them were African countries. So you have very high growth in both frontier and emerging markets. The other good news is that these countries have been transformed from being net debtors to net creditors. If you look at foreign reserves, starting in 2005, the foreign reserves in emerging markets have surpassed that of the developed countries, and the gap is getting wider and wider. And by the way, this is one of the reasons why I'm so optimistic about Europe. I just came back from Europe, and everybody's so glum. I said, I'm very optimistic. He said, why? Because you've got all these foreign reserves in emerging markets. They come to Europe, and they look at the assets. They look at the people, a lot of capable people, and they say, hey, we want to buy this. Which is why you're seeing Carlos Slim from Mexico. By the way, Slim is not so slim anymore. But anyway, very nice guy. If you ever want to interview somebody who's really down to earth, he's quite a guy. But he has now bought the into the Dutch telephone company. Geely has bought Volvo, Geely of China, and then in India, Tata has bought Jaguar, and so forth and so on. You're going to see more of that, and I think it's very good for Europe. The other good news is debt. The debt levels of emerging markets are less in terms of GDP than the developed countries. And you can see the trend here. The debt levels for emerging markets going down, debt levels for developed markets going up. And it's not only public debt, but private debt. These numbers show you the blue are the developed countries, the red and yellow are the emerging countries, both private and public debt. The other good news is that interest rates have come down. Inflation, of course, has come down dramatically. In the early 90s, you can see inflation was very high, averaging in emerging markets. In Latin America, the inflation was running at thousands of percent. In Brazil, you had thousands of percent inflation. And I remember arriving at Rio de Janeiro airport and meeting my Brazilian friends, and they said, I told them, look, 2,000%, this is insane. He said, no, it's wonderful. I said, what do you mean? He said, last week it was 3,000%. So, I mean, you know, things are all relative, but now you got single-digit inflation. Of course, short-term interest rates have really come down dramatically. Valuations. We are bargain hunters, so we want to find bargains. And if you look at the middle there, the April this year, 10 times average earnings in emerging markets. That's very, very cheap. The low point was in 2008, but that was a very, very short period of time, and the high point in 88, 28 times. So we're finding lots of bargains, partly because of all these IPOs that have come in. The long-term view, if we look at emerging markets from a long-term perspective, this is the index, by the way, going back to 1988. You'll see there are three bars there. Those yellow bars are bear markets. By the way, we define a bear market as a 30% or more decline. I know some people used to define a bear market as 20%. Believe me, 20% these days is nothing. It's a little blip on the screen. So if you look at the 30% declines, you'll see there are only three of them, and those bars are very narrow, very short in duration. So you're seeing a phenomenon where these bear markets are frightening, they're sudden, they're unexpected. A lot of people bail out at the bottom, and then, of course, there's a big recovery after it, and you see bull markets going longer. So in essence, if you summarize this, you'll see that on the average, the bull markets went up by 423%, lasted an average of 69 months, and the bear markets went down an average of 57%, lasted an average of 14 months. So one thing you can say that's very clear, bull markets last longer than bear markets. Bull markets go up more than bear markets go down. So many years ago, we were in a conference and we were taking questions from the audience, and our chairman took one question from a young lady who got up and said, Sir John Templeton was our chairman at that time, Sir John, I'd like to know when should I invest? I've just inherited some money. I'd like to know when should I go in? And Sir John said, young lady, the best time to invest is when you have money. And I thought to myself, that's a strange thing to say, until I looked at this. And I realized what he was saying is that, you know, you dollar cost average, same amount each time, and you're going to hit bull markets most of the time. If you hit a bear market, you're going to buy a lot more shares for that same amount of money, and when it recovers, you'll be in very good shape. We have a Twitter blog, and we have various publications. You're welcome to tune into those to find out what we're thinking at any point in time. And I'll close it there. Thank you very much. Yes, I'd be happy to take any questions you may have. Yes, in the back there.
Please identify yourselves.
I'm Kevin. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Yes.
I would like to have your opinion in RMB. So lately, you know, the RMB is kind of choppy, you know. Is it, what's your view? Is it going to be appreciate against dollar or going to be more choppy, you know, in the future?
I feel that over the long term, the RMB will appreciate against the dollar. There'll be a continuous appreciation. It will be in a very measured pace, and you will have times when there are dramatic downturns in the RMB, particularly when the Chinese government sees fit to fully liberalize the foreign exchange market. Then you'll have volatility. You'll have people moving in and out and so forth. But I think over the long term, the RMB will appreciate, simply because the economic growth and productivity in China is increasing dramatically. I just was in Shenyang, China, up north, visiting the BMW plant. And it was amazing. Well, of course, the first thing was that they're tripling the capacity. But the more interesting thing was that the degree of automation was quite amazing in this plant, which means that China is really jumping, leapfrogging the technology gap into very productive enterprises. And that, of course, with high productivity, will help the currency. And the other thing that's happening, of course, is that China is moving into more high value-added products. You may all be familiar with Huawei, the telecoms giant, now competing with Ericsson, Alcatel, and all these global players. And as I travel around the world, we visit telecom companies, and they say, look, we're buying Huawei equipment. It's just as good as Ericsson, and the service is good, et cetera, et cetera. So you're going to see more and more of that, and that, of course, drives the currency. So over the long term, currency is going to appreciate, I believe.
Okay. Over here, please.
Hi, Paul Garvey from The Australian. One emerging market that had a lot of attention here a year ago was Mongolia. Everyone seemed to be wanting to invest in there. Share prices were running and that sort of thing. What we've seen since then has been a lot of tinkering the legislation. Share prices have come off a lot. There's an election there next week. Do you think that that's sort of the catalyst where things might turn around, some of that uncertainty might disappear, or are the challenges there a bit more endemic?
I think it's going to be challenging. We were in Mongolia last year, and I could never forget it. We went to visit the Genghis Khan vodka factory. And I took my Korean colleagues, because I told them, look, you guys Korean, there's some relationship, you know, the Mongols, Manchurian, you know, the whole thing, you've got to be there because, you know, there's some cultural affinity. And they came, and one of our Korean analysts, we went into this vodka factory, he sampled the vodka and almost fell down. He had to go to sleep in the car. So that was the first adventure. Anyway, it's a beautiful country, it's all great, but the bottom line is that they're not ready for a real capital market revolution. There are two factors, I think, that are very, well, three factors. One, they're torn between Russia and China. I remember meeting with the Ivanhoe people who have a coal mine on near the Chinese border. And I said, how are you getting this to China, the coal? He says, we're trucking it. I said, how about train? He said, the problem is the gauge, you know, the width of the tracks is Russian gauge in Mongolia, and in China it's different. And I said, well, why don't you put in Chinese tracks? He said, oh no, the government will not allow it. So this is a number one problem for the guys who want to ship things to China. The other problem is that they're not set up in their mindset to share these resources. There's still a lot of debates about how much they want to allow the foreigners to do. And this is reflected in the stock market, because when you meet the brokers and other people, you ask them, okay, I want to stop buying stock. Do you have a custodial bank? You know, every place we invest, we need a custodial bank to safekeep our securities. No custodial setup. So this gives you an insight into the problem you're going to have with this country unless they get their act together in the capital market arena. So I'm not saying there are no good opportunities. I'm just saying that we have to be a little more cautious. Same thing is true of Myanmar, by the way. You know, the infrastructure has to be put in place before you can really operate in these places. We can do private equity and go indirectly. For example, you can buy Ivanhoe in Canada. You can buy one of the Australian mining companies that has operations there. But to go indirectly is going to take more time, I believe.
Tim, you have another one?
Yeah, behind you.
Oh, sorry.
You mentioned about going to BMW in Shenyang and Tata buying Jaguar Land Rover. How far away do you think that some of these emerging markets are in producing their own brands that will have global recognition? And how important is that for emerging markets?
It is happening. I just gave you the example of Huawei. I mean, if you talk to any telecoms operator anywhere in the world, they know Huawei, because Huawei has come in and offered them 20% off what Ericsson is offering them with very good equipment. So there are quite a few brands now that are gradually being filtering into the global market. But one of the things you are going to see is acquisition of famous brands by Chinese and other emerging market countries in Europe and America. And this, of course, is already taking place. I mentioned Volvo, I mentioned Jaguar, but you can go down the list. It's quite remarkable how many brands have been purchased. Sports brands have been purchased as well. So, you know, it's a trade-off. If you're a Chinese company, do you want to create your own brand or do you want to buy another brand? And you've got to look at the economics of both sides. In many cases, they're doing both. They're, you know, promoting their own brand and they're buying foreign brands.
Okay. Who else? Back over here on the side, please.
Hi, thanks. I'm Sheridan Prasso with Bloomberg News. I'd like to ask you about the IPO market, which has been it's been so lackluster that we haven't seen the depths of this since early 2009. And I wonder if you think the shine is sort of permanently off IPOs, particularly coming out of places like China, or if this is just a temporary lull.
No, I mean, it's very much driven by the bullish sentiment. I mean, when you have a very bullish market, a lot of IPOs come in because they can get a high price. Then when the market comes down, you'll see, you know, the issuers pull back. A graph, for example, the diamond retailer pulled back, said we want to get a high valuation, so we'll wait. So it's just these waves of sentiment that you will have. In the case of China, I know a lot of people, when I go to the U.S., by the way, they ask about China corporate governance because of the China forestry and all these disasters in the U.S. market. But the reality is that China will still be a very big issuer of IPOs going forward. And the numbers I showed you will continue in terms of percentages, because there are many, many companies in China that want to go to the market. And the state-owned enterprises will be increasing their share issuance. The banks, I mean, when they had the subprime in China and the banks were told by the government to lend aggressively, they knew their NPLs, non-performing loans, would go up. So they started going to the market to raise more capital to strengthen their balance sheet. So I don't see any let up on that. By the way, I've got the China expert in our group, Eddie Chow, here. Eddie, what's your thinking on that?
Sure, I think, you know, the IPO market is definitely more a function of the market sentiment. You know, when market is good, you know, the iBankers can push out, you know, their deals, you know, at good multiples. You know, when the market is bad, you know, people will just stay behind and wait for a little longer. And I think in general, we are overall a bit skeptical on all this new listing. You know, for us, you know, we are more interested in looking at, you know, kind of trying to find the treasure, you know, on all these, you know, more seasoned, you know, with longer, you know, listing history to companies. You know.
Yeah, you won't see us very often buying these IPOs.
Oh, back here in the middle, please.
Hi, Guy Fulton from the Canada Pension Plan. Do you think the large volume of retirees in the West, in the US, UK, the baby boom generation, as they're retiring and taking a lot of money out of the markets, cashing savings plans for retirements, do you think that's going to cause a structural fall in stock markets over the next, you know, the medium to long term?
That's a very good point, because you are seeing in the States some of these pension funds now pulling money out because they have demands. You see, the problem, this is again, the mistakes people make, even though you talk to them till you're blue in the face, they put everything into fixed income because they think that's safe. And you and I know fixed income is not necessarily safe. Just because they, okay, if you hold a bond to maturity, you're going to be guaranteed that bond, hopefully, unless you bought Greek bonds. So that's the first thing. So they're all in fixed income. They all think that treasuries is the safest thing since sliced bread. And they're getting 1% or 2%. Okay, interest rates keep on being pushed down by the Fed. On paper, it looks like they're making money because their bonds are worth more when interest rates go down. But at the end of the day, they can't satisfy a 5% return or a 10% return that they would need to meet the demands of their retirees, which is why you're absolutely right. Some of these pension funds, not all, are pulling back. They're selling, you know, in order to meet these demands, these everyday demands. The good news is that they're being replaced by emerging market pension plans. You get Singapore, you get, now China is doing a lot in, you know, building pension plans. A good example is Chile. The Chilean pension market is so big, they own 1/3 of the entire Chilean market. In fact, they're buying our funds now because they're, you know, they can't buy any more of their own market, otherwise they'd dominate the whole thing. So I think your point is very well taken. It could present a problem, temporary problem at different times. If these funds are not able to move more into equities, because equities at the end of the day will have a better long-term potential for them. I'm not saying they can't make money in fixed income. We have a fixed income emerging market fund that's done very well, as good as the equity. But that means you're trading on the yields, you're trading on the currency. So, you know, you have to be really active.
Yes. And here in the middle, please, again.
Hello, Alison Cook from CV Star. I'm sure this doesn't qualify as an emerging market, but I just wanted to get your view on your prognosis for the Japanese economy.
Japanese economy, I cannot understand, and I can't understand the stock market either. It's so impenetrable. And a lot of it can be explained by, I don't know whether any of you have read the famous book by Ruth Benedict. She wrote a book about Japan during the war, The Chrysanthemum and the Sword. You should read it. She had never visited Japan, but she got an insight into the mentality, Agiri and On. This idea of obligation and duty and so forth. So you have a situation, very strange situation in Japan, where people put money in the bank because they're obligated to support the bank. The bank buys JCB bonds because the government tells them you're obligated to buy Japanese bonds. The government then spends this on infrastructure, and the circle is continuing. So you have this chart I showed you. Japan is the most indebted country in the world, but there's no problem, because people keep on holding these bonds and feeding them. So this is something that is has nothing to do with the market dynamics, you see. And so it's very difficult to understand. I personally feel that Japan will do fine. You know, why? Because they've got Japan with China. China is growing at a rapid rate, and Japan has the know-how, the technology, et cetera, they can, you know, utilize in China and other parts of the world. So I'm not too worried, but don't tell me how to figure out the Japanese stock market. I can't figure it out. Corporate governance, as you know, doesn't exist in that sense.
Over here, please.
Hi, Mark. You mentioned earlier in the States, many investors asked you about the corporate governance in the emerging market. And you know that most of the growth lies in the small and mid-cap companies. And very often, these companies are most prone to the accounting issues and corporate governance. And how do you get around it in your investment?
Well, I tell you, corporate governance is bad everywhere. In fact, I was 2 months ago, I was in the U.S. speaking to a group of bankers, And one of them got up in the audience and said, hey, how about emerging markets corporate governance? I heard it's really bad. And I said, well, you know, corporate governance in emerging markets is almost as bad as the U.S. And they said, what do you mean by that? I said, look at Facebook. This is the biggest IPO you've had, and there's no voting rights for minorities. This guy in a T-shirt or a hood, as you remind me, makes a $1 billion decision without consulting a board of directors. Come on, give me a break. The U.S. is just as bad as everybody else. And that's the reason why we have to emphasize, you got to do your homework. Whether it's a big company, a small company, as you know, we've had some huge disasters in Asia on corporate governance. Remember Asia Pulp and Paper? Anybody remember that one? I mean, you know, so you have to do your homework, and hopefully the guys who are doing the accounting are not going to be corrupted. As you know, in India, there was $1 billion missing from Satyam. $1 billion missing. And it was interesting because the auditors were our auditors in India. We have a very big operation in India. And when they came up for renewal, I said, I'm not going to approve them. And everybody said, oh, no, you can't do that. I said, why not? He says, we don't even know what happened. They put our auditors in jail. They won't let us see them. So, you know, these are the problems you run into. And you really have to go, whether it's a small company or a big company. Frankly, I find that the small companies are often better because you can get access, you know. You can get to the top management and really look in their eye and get some feel for what they're doing and what they're saying. One of the things, for example, that we always look at is derivatives. You know, derivatives are one of the big risks that we face globally, because now derivatives are worth $700 trillion. That's 10 times more than the total GDP of the world. And you go into a company and you ask them, what are you doing in derivatives? And they say, oh, this is fantastic. We're making a lot of money on derivatives. Immediately I sell. Because you know they're gambling, basically. You know, it's a real risk that you take. So it's this kind of thing that you got to have, you know, you won't see necessarily in the books, because a lot of this will be off the balance sheet, and you have to ask them about what you're doing.
When you go to a Chinese company and they say they're buying a lot of real estate, do you sell?
Yeah, good idea. The trouble is, you won't know it very often, because they said, oh, we have a special projects vehicle, you know, that's off the balance sheet sometimes. You can find it in the notes, but very often you won't get that information. But they're absolutely right. A lot of the money that was lent to these companies went into real estate. Yeah.
Am I missing anybody out on the balcony, out on the veranda there? Okay, one here. Yes, please.
Hi, Tony Watson from Lim Advisors here in Hong Kong. Sales and management fees on mutual funds in Asia versus the rest of the world. Can you give us your view and some comments on the future direction?
Yes, it's a very, very important topic, because these sales and, you see, if you look at the mutual fund industry, there are the sales fees, then there are the, how can I say, the bureaucratic fees, the fees for the accounting and all the rest of that stuff, and then there's the management fee. So you've got to add these all up, and it might come to 3%, as much as that. And if you're in a sales situation where the salesmen are getting paid a lot more, your first hit will be very high, which is why the industry has often said, look, we won't give you a sales fee, but we'll deduct a small amount. If you keep in for the next 10 years, then, you know, your fees will be lower and so forth and so on. I would say the trend in the industry for institutional money is probably going down. In other words, for the big institutions that have billions of dollars, the amount, you know, the fee amounts will be declining. But for the retail side, probably not very much. Because, you know, one of the tenets of our industry is that mutual funds are not bought, they're sold. And that is the reality. I mean, you're not going to be able to get people to buy funds unless somebody meets them personally, sits down with them, explains to them, and so forth. And this costs money. You've got to have a salesman out there. Interestingly enough, in the UK, I don't know whether you've been following that, they have now eliminated, for the financial advisors, eliminated the fees. In other words, they're not allowed to take any fees from the mutual fund provider, the mutual fund company. They must take their fee from the client. And that's changing the industry as well, because it'll be more objective, let's put it that way.
Yes.
Okay. Jake? No? Oh, okay, I thought you had one. Over here on the side, please. Over here. Right there. Thank you.
Hi, Mark. I'm Leslie Tang from Channel News Asia. I have a question about China. There's a lot of concern about a steep economic slowdown. So do you think China is in for a hard landing, and do you think it will be able to achieve that 7.5% growth target?
I don't see any hard or soft landing. In fact, I don't think China's landing. They're continuing to fly. Whether you look at 6%, 5%, 7%, 8%, this all is very high growth. You know, 5% growth is five times more what the U.S. is doing. I personally think it will be closer to 8. And Eddie, I don't know whether we debate internally. What do you say? You can stick your neck out. Nobody will hurt.
I think, you know, 8% is quite a fair, you know, projection. You know, if you look at the first quarter, you know, they have 8.1, but still in the first quarter we have seen the impact from the slowdown in exports. You know, but I think with the second half they're going to put in, you know, more stimulus. You know, and with the rate cut, I think there's hopefully it's quite, you know, possible that, you know, they can do 8% this year.
It's interesting, you know, the government has set its target of 7.5. They usually are conservative, so we think it's going to be 8. By the way, you all must realize, you have to look at the numbers. What is the leading indicators? What do they say? The leading indicators, even with the HSBC leading indicator, it's down below the average a little bit, but it's nowhere near where it was during subprime. And if you look at the leading indicators for the OECD countries, for the U.S., they're all up. So don't think that the world is stopping. You know, life goes on and growth is still there. In fact, we revised our global numbers from, or are now revising from less than 1 to maybe 1. So I think we have to be very careful in rushing to inclusion. If there's a little bit of a slowdown, that is going to continue. Because don't forget also, the U.S. keeps on pumping money into the system and lowering interest rates. I'm sure they've convinced Merkel to do the same thing in Europe. I'm not so concerned about Europe because I realize it takes time. They've got to negotiate. It's a game of chicken. You know, guys don't want to give up their perks, and they've got to give them up. And they don't want, you know, all this goes on, and it's going to take time. But I believe that Europe will do fine at the end of the day. They will achieve a fiscal union.
Back here, please, and then one more here, and then I think we need to wrap up.
Tim Islow, Lee Fox Strategy International. Mark, you mentioned about your book, Trading with China. You wrote it back in about 40 years ago. That's really foresightful. What do you predict in 20 years' time about the prospect of surface industry in China? Surface industry, surface sector. Thank you.
The service industry in China is going to grow like leaps and bounds because they will be transforming, as I mentioned, from an export-led economy, export of products, to domestic consumption. And what does that mean? It means banking, consumer banking. It means credit cards. It means retail industries. It means all kinds of medical services with the aging population, hospital care, massage parlors, entertainment, you name it, they're going to have it, and that's going to grow very, very fast going forward. So I think you're going to see a very, by the way, if you look at China, where China's going to be in 20 years' time, you've got to look at the U.S. The progression of the U.S. economy will be duplicated in China.
up here, please.
Hi, Mark. Good to see you again. I'd like to learn your view on two questions. First of all, the use of expert network in for research has been quite controversial in the States. What's your thinking related to that, and what's your team policy regarding that? The other is...
What's the US?
The expert network, like, for example, a company like GLG gathering a group of industry people to talk to investors, to give them so-called insight. Just wonder whether your team is using that or not. The other point is that you have been...
No, we don't use it.
Okay, obviously.
When we listen, I listen to the podcasts of all these programs, the Bloomberg podcasts,
okay,
and all those, which are interesting.
Right. And as you have been like long fund investors for many years, right, given you have seen the growth of the hedge fund industry, any interest in moving over to change your style a bit to become a hedge fund manager?
You know, it's interesting. I mentioned that a few years back. No, about a year now. It's been about a year back. And I was inundated with brokers saying, you know, we want to be your prime broker. As I mentioned, you got to be careful about derivatives. But we use derivatives in our fixed income area. And we think they have a role to play. And we are looking at the hedge fund arena. But we haven't done anything yet. But, you know, we're open-minded. We look at everything to see if it makes sense. See, the way I look at it is that if you want to do a hedge fund, you should think about a hedged fund, not a hedge fund, in the sense that the original purpose of a hedge fund was to lower the volatility and lower the downside. Now, there's no free lunch. If you want to lower your downside and buy derivatives to do that, you're giving away on the upside. It's just dollars and cents. So there is a demand for that sort of thing. No question. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mark was noticing the New York Times, the FCC reporter's notebooks that we all carry here. And so as a result, we've got a pack of them for
thank
him.
You. Thank you very much.
Straight from the front office downstairs. Thank you all for coming. We hope to see you at our next event. Thank you. Mm-hmm.